Would you be seated, please? It is the night of Jesus' arrest. And here in the Gospel of John, he utters this great prayer for the unity and protection of the followers that he is about to leave behind. It's a prayer that we now hear as a prayer for the church, for us, entrusted as we are with putting our Christianity into practice in our own context without Jesus standing right here as a personal coach. I wonder if you noticed how frequently Jesus refers to the world in this prayer. In 13 verses, 13 times. I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world. I'm not asking you to take them out of the world. They don't belong to the world, or in Greek, they are not of the world, just as I do not belong or am not of the world. As you have sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. Just like deacons at the end of the service, right? Away you go. Go, 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 go. And to be sure, over the centuries, Christians have struggled deeply with this whole question of our place in the world and the world's place in our theology and practice and preaching. The most influential and significant treatment of this question in modern times was a book entitled Christ and Culture. It was written in 1951 by Protestant theologian Richard Niebuhr. Now, Niebuhr wrote, of course, post-Nazi Germany and the sort of complete acquiescence of the church in Nazi policies, but also at a time, because he taught in America, at a time when middle-class America, or at least the power base of middle-class America, was pretty homogeneous. Think June and Ward Cleaver and the white picket fences. And it was a time when the idea of Christendom still seemed a possible and a good thing. We didn't have, remember, in 1951, we did not have a television in every living room forcing us to recognize, perhaps for the first time, that our way of life wasn't actually the only way of life. So there really wasn't any differentiation between church and society. Church was society at prayer. Now, when John wrote his gospel, however, a very different arrangement obtained. So remember that the first Christians were Jews, and they were living amongst pagan Gentiles in a Roman culture that was so despised that they referred to Rome as Babylon. And indeed, it had been during the time of their exile in Babylon, several hundred years earlier, that the Jews had first codified all those distinctive customs and practices, such as dress, diet, keeping of Sabbath, and so on. Those practices that allowed them to preserve their distinctive identity and avoid being swallowed up by the dominant Babylonian culture. So it's not surprising that when the first Christians showed their willingness to reach out to the Gentiles, this resulted in their ultimate expulsion from the synagogue. It was in the DNA of the Jewish people to remain distinct from Gentiles. But then you see, as enemies of the state, Christians as enemies of the state, were subject to persecution and death because they would not swear allegiance to Caesar as the Son of God. Which, if you've ever seen the coinage of the time, it actually has Caesar's head and says, Son of God. And so they had to become very careful about fraternizing with people who might betray them to the authorities. So in other words, contrary to the 1950s, there was an exceedingly clear distinction between the church and the world, just for the sake of preservation and protection. And you hear Jesus praying for that in this prayer. Now, as you well know, this situation changed radically when in the year 312, the Emperor Constantine realized that he could effect great advantage if he could just marry the interests of the church and state. And so he converted to Christianity. Now, as you can imagine, many Christians welcomed this turn of events, since it would naturally signal the end of persecution, and besides a few little preferments that had heretofore been unavailable to them. But others took grave exception, fearing that the Roman culture, this Babylonian culture, was a contaminant. And their response, by contrast, was to withdraw to the nearby desert and live as hermits in these loosely associated communities. You may have heard of the desert fathers, and there were some desert mothers as well. So here we're seeing the very earliest roots of monasticism, which has developed in many ways since then, but initially it was conceived as a retreat from the world in order to be able to live a pure Christian life. Well, so much for the history lesson. All of this is by way of saying that in one way or another, the history of Christianity has been the story of these changing degrees of engagement with the world. So, with the tip of the hat to Niebuhr, who, by the way, would not recognize a thing that I'm about to say, so, I mean, it's just, he gave me the idea to talk about this, that's about it, okay? Let me draw the brush strokes of three broad positions. The first is what Niebuhr himself called Christ against culture, in opposition, church against society. And in this scenario, Christians are deeply suspicious of people that they call non-believers. And there's a clear line between us and them. So you don't consort with, and you certainly don't marry, somebody from outside the snug little flock of believers. No cards, no alcohol, no dancing, no fun. And as our own catechism put it, if you lose me at some point, or I lose you, you can look up the catechism and see, baptism implied that we had, quote, renounced the devil and all his works, the vain pomp and glory of the world, and all the sinful desires of the flesh. That sounds like a pretty world-renouncing spirituality to me. And it may all sound dour and antisocial, and perhaps it is. But just for the record, it is also true that we may place in this camp those people who have been willing to endure suffering and shame and loss and persecution for the sake of their Christian convictions. Think of pacifists, for instance, or people who speak out with a clear prophetic and critical voice, come what may. Think of Nelson Mandela and all those years on Robben Island, or of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, speaking of Nazi Germany. Now, at the other end of the spectrum is what Niebuhr called the Christ of culture. And given his context, you may guess that he has the least good to say about this option. In this view, there's really little or no sense of tension at all between the gospel on the one hand and our social mores, our economics, our politics, our foreign policy, or our approach even to the goodness of progress as to be achieved at any cost. Rather, there's a somewhat mindless equation of culture with Christianity. And if you think about it, our missionary efforts were a good example of this. We assumed that our cultural affectations went along with gospel, including our dress, hairstyles, Victorian hymns. Somehow we thought these things were just the ticket in Africa or Northern Canada. That's the kind of thinking that got us into the residential schools crisis. Once a society identifies Christ with culture, a few other things follow on. Baptism begins to be seen as a birthright rather than a choice to live a particular kind of life. And you may remember that there were huge debates about that in our churches in the 70s and 80s. When it comes to the Bible, people who equate Christ and culture tend to use the Bible as a source of proof texts. So they favor those biblical texts that support the status quo. Or when they want to clinch an argument, they have a habit of bringing in Jesus to anoint their point of view. But once again, it's not all negative, because we might also point out that it is often those who work cooperatively within the cultural apparatus who are best able to effect positive change. And the mention of change brings us to what Niebuhr would call Christ the transformer of culture. And in this view, we see ourselves as participants in a culture, willing participants in a culture, which falls short of God's will as revealed in and by Christ. Our role, then, is to mend and rehabilitate the world. Now, I have to say that from my perspective, this view takes much better account of our theology of the incarnation, which is fundamentally that the created order, matter, culture, all of these things are fundamentally good. That God is willing to engage God's self, bind God's self to us and to our way of life, even to the point of suffering and death. So what that means is that we too, who have been sent into the world, we too, in the name of Christ, are called to challenge anything. Just open your paper and think about this for a minute. Anything that falls short of kingdom values: mercy, justice, truth, peace. We are called to transform anything, organizations, structures, personal interactions in our families, in our work, with our friends, anything that is not characterized by what Christians have called the fruit of the Spirit. Namely, here they are: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, loyalty, gentleness, self-control. What do you think might happen if we were the agents transforming every place in which we live and move and have our being, such that these were the qualities of our every interaction? Now, I will grant that these three positions are very complex, they are highly nuanced, and that at any given time we may find ourselves gravitating towards one or another of them, and that's important for the sake of balance. I also believe that there are people in our midst who are called to be vocal champions of one or the other. How we Christians are to relate to our world is a difficult and fraught question. But what I do know is this: if we ignore or downplay our relationship with the world, we do so at our own peril. Amen.